Want to drive greater success in social commerce? With Deloitte's latest creator economy research, you can. After surveying over 500 creators and 500 brands, our insights are helping CMOs and marketing teams harness the power of content creators. And not only that, but how to do it well. See for yourself by visiting cmo.deloitte.com today.
What's the first brand you remember as a child being resonant with you?
Varnays and Topsiders. I was a kid that didn't have any money, and Varnays cost $55 and Topsiders cost $33. And I remember when I got my first job as a box boy at San Vicente Foods, where I joined my first union, and I made $11 an hour, which was a shit ton of money for a 16-year-old. And I was able to buy my first pair of Varnays and my first real pair, not knockoffs of Sperry Topsiders. So Varnay and Topsiders.
Hi, I'm Jim Stengel, and I help major brands find their purpose and activate it, and the profits follow. For 7 years, I was the global marketing officer for Procter & Gamble, where I oversaw the marketing of hundreds of brands. You may not know it, but the CMOs, the chief marketing officers of all of your favorite brands, are trying to connect you with your favorite products and services through purpose. And on this show, I delve into how they do it. Today, my guest on the CMO podcast is Scott Galloway, and this is a good one. Scott's been a colleague of mine for many years. We do a program together where we train CMOs at the festival in Cannes every year. So some background on Scott. He's a professor at NYU. He's an author. He's a big tech gadfly. He's a TV personality. He's an entrepreneur. He has started three companies and sold them. He's written two best-selling books. One is called The Big Four, and the second one is called The Algebra of Happiness, and it's launching as we speak. What I love today about the conversation with Scott is it was different. He's not a CMO, but he counsels a lot of CMOs, and he's one of the smartest person I've ever met in all of my life in business and branding. And what's different about today is he shares a concept of how branding is, in a way, dead. The era of branding is over. And there's another era that we're entering into, and we get into that in some detail. He also talks an awful about a lot about happiness, what he's learned about happiness, and he talks about kind of when he's at his happiest and when he sees leaders at their happiest, and he talks a lot about what CMOs should be doing. Here's my conversation with Scott. So, Scott Galloway, I am so looking forward to our chat today. I left Procter & Gamble 10 years ago, almost to the day. And you were, you don't know this, but you were a role model for what I wanted to do in my post-P&G life.
Erectile dysfunction and watch a lot of Netflix?
Well, maybe. Maybe. I have done that, actually.
How's that for kicking off a podcast on CMOs? How's that?
That's good. It's a good start.
Did the CMO of JP Morgan kick off that way? Be honest, Jim.
She was cool, but no, it was a bit different. It's a bit different.
Yeah. So I'm a role.
So listen.
Call. I'm a role.
Listen.
Call for
no, you hate this. I know, but I love your life. Right. This whole portfolio. You're an author, a teacher, an entrepreneur, a writer, and I just want and I visited a whole bunch of people who had lifestyles that I admired, and I admired you a bit from a distance. I didn't get to meet you until later, but I want you to share with me and us today what you love about your life and what drives you nuts.
Sure. So incredibly blessed. And it's easy to credit your character and your grit, your blessings or your, you know, the good things that happened to you and then blame the market for your failures. I have no such delusions. I'm here talking to you and get to provide economic security for me and my family, which is primarily the reason I work. And unlike what I first started doing when I was an investment banker right out of UCLA, I really do enjoy what I do. And, I feel relevant. I have a nice time doing it. I make a good living. So yeah, I'm really blessed. And it's because of the generosity and vision of California taxpayers and the Regents of UC. It was education that changed my life. So yeah, I like what I do a lot. And thanks for saying that. It's a nice compliment. But the only thing that in my life that isn't perfect, that does, you know, quote unquote, drives me crazy is planes, trains, and automobiles. The nature of what we do, Jim, is we have to go to other, you know, other offices and other people. And I just spend a lot of time, you know, getting molested by a guy named Rob from TSA. And it just, it just takes the security at airports, the air in a tube, the crappy food on the road. Travel is the only thing in my life that isn't fantastic. When you're young, you love business travel. As you get older, it just becomes, becomes difficult. So I try to stay focused on the 99% that's wonderful.
Yep. Well, I'm a big Delta traveler. I'm sure you are as well. And we're going to have the Delta CMO on this podcast at some point. So I'm kind of a Delta fan. Of all the travel companies and airlines, I think they try the hardest.
I think Delta does a great job. And I don't know if this is, I don't know if they pay you. So I don't know if this is working out really well for you. But I think Delta has the best product in the market. Look, the best product in the market are the Gulf airlines that are subsidized by their local governments. It's sort of like flying Amazon. You're getting $1.05 worth of product for a buck. But in terms of for-profit airlines domestically, which they all have to operate under, Delta has the best product.
Yeah. Listen, you talked about your education a minute ago, UCLA. My wife is a proud Bruin, and my daughter is a double Bruin, and it got them off to a great start. I want you to talk a little bit about why UCLA was so special to you, and then I want you to talk a little bit about this move to hire people without college degrees. Google said that, Apple, IBM, and I think a degree is still important for a lot of reasons. I'd like you to wax a bit on that.
Sure. So this is a passion project for mine. Public education changed my life, and I got into UCLA last minute. I was set to pursue a career of installing shelving. My father got me a job installing shelving for $18 an hour, which seemed like a lot of money at the time. And I couldn't go to college unless I was going to be able to go to UCLA because my mother lived behind the school and I was going to get to live at home. We didn't have a lot of money. I was raised by a single mother who lived and died a secretary. So that my household income was never above kind of $35,000. So it was either UCLA or shelving. And nothing wrong with manual labor. But they called me. I got rejected initially, and I went through something called an appeal process. And I remember the day that I got a call from a person in the admissions office saying, look, you're a native son of California and we want to do right by you. And they let me into UCLA with what was a very mediocre GPA. And also I was one of those kids that didn't have great grades, but didn't test well either. I had really mediocre SATs and it changed my life. I was able to get a job at Morgan Stanley, and then with the credibility of Morgan Stanley, I was able to get into business school, and with the credibility and contacts of business school, I was able to start my first company, Profit Brand Strategy, which we grew to, I think it's about 400 or 500 people now, sold that to Dentsu and started this kind of upward march professionally. And it was because of the blessing of, state sponsored education. So for me, it was just life-changing, full stop. And the thing that worries me is that, we seem to have fallen out of love with the unremarkable. So I describe myself as, especially as a young man, as remarkably unremarkable. And I think that the University of California's mission has always been to help create remarkable futures for unremarkable people. And I feel as if education, including my university, NYU, has fallen out of love with the unremarkables. And we haven't increased our first year seats fast enough to increase to catch up with demand. And as a result, we're drunk on exclusivity. Every year we brag about how impossible it is to get into our university. And that's like a homeless shelter bragging that they're turning away more and more people. We've kind of lost the script, Jim. I think as academics and as universities, we've no longer think of ourselves as public servants, but as luxury goods. And I would argue that the University of California has not lost the script.
What about the companies that are saying that a college degree is no longer required to be hired?
Well, okay, if you're Google, so a lot of parents come up to me and say, my kid's thinking about not going to college or didn't like his freshman year and is thinking about dropping out. And they kind of say, well, maybe he or she is the next Steve Jobs. And I would say, no, he or she isn't. And it's generally you should assume you are not that person. There are some people who don't need college, who go on, who are so talented, so hardworking, get into the ecosystem of the information economy. And I just think in general, you should assume that you and your children are not those people. If you look at the amount of money, the incremental delta and income and opportunities you're afforded with an education, it's just a really good plan B. And I worry that there's a small group of people that are so remarkably successful without a college degree, whether it's Mark Zuckerberg or Jay-Z or or Kim Kardashian, that we begin to believe that this is where the economy is headed. I do not think this is where the economy is headed. As a matter of fact, I think it's headed the other way, and that it's becoming more and more important that if you don't at least have a college degree, you have some kind of certification, whether it's a esthetician's license, a class 3 driver's license, a scuba certification, I don't know, whatever it might be. But we're in an economy where if you can't put it on LinkedIn and separate yourself from the other 7.5 billion people in the world, you should assume to make on average what they make, which is not a lot. So I think certification and a college degree is absolutely still the way to go.
So Scott, this is the CMO podcast, and you're the first non-CMO as a guest.
All right.
So, but you work with a lot of CMOs, you've started companies that have helped CMOs. So I'd like to get your take today on the CMO, the role, the people. What are they doing right? What are they screwing up? Anyone you admire? So I'd like you to shift gears a little bit into the life of a CMO.
Sure. So being a CMO now is kind of like being kind of second lieutenant or whatever they call it, riding point in Vietnam, and that your life expectancy isn't that high. I think the life expectancy for CMOs is 18 to 24 months. So
it's a little higher now, but not much. It's not quite 4 years. I think it's about 3.5.
Oh, so it's gone up dramatically.
Yeah, okay. But that's still half. It's still half of what the tenure of a CEO is.
Yeah,
so it still lags their peers in the C-suite.
Yeah, look, it depends on the firm, but I think immediately you have to identify the role and get the requisite authority, because whenever you're in a role that doesn't have a P&L, where you're mostly just an expense, you're kind of vulnerable, and unless you establish value add pretty quickly. Everything's fine. And then they wake up in the first bad quarter and they say, well, what do we cut? And as you know, Jim, marketing is usually sort of the easiest thing to cut and probably the most dangerous thing to cut in a downturn. Sometimes the CMO role is people all of a sudden discover marketing, but haven't discovered the cost and the requisite investment around marketing. And they create this thing called CMO. And then again, 2-3 years later, this person doesn't have any achievements because they haven't been provided the artillery. A lot of times the CMO doesn't have the authority to tell brands how to behave. So as a result, they're kind of begging the company to do things, and it doesn't work out. I think CMO is arguably one of the most difficult positions or roles in the company. And you speak to more CMOs than I do. Would you agree with that? Where do I get that wrong, Jim?
No, I think you're spot on. I think versus other functions in the C-suite, it's the function that has the most disparity between companies. If you go to, I don't know, 20 companies, you look at the CFO role, the HR role, the head of R&D, the CEO role, you know, they're relatively the same. But if you do the same with marketing, it's all over the map, which I think is a big issue. And one of the first things I ask a CMO if they ask me for help is, what do you work on? You know, how do you spend your time? What's your core work? And I, you know, when I became CMO of P&G, I did an audit of what our people were doing with their time, and I got a good sample. And it was mostly packaging changes and organizing meetings. And, you know, a great marketing company that's not their core work. So I think it comes down to, you know, the biggest indication of what's valued is where we spend our time. And I think that's too all over the map, and it's not as focused on customer delight and growth and organization building and transformation as it needs to be.
CMO is very amorphous, which is very dangerous unless upfront you're in real kind of lockstep around what the CEO is expecting of you, what your metrics are, and as we said, the requisite resources.
So why do you think that is, Scott? I mean, you teach at a university. I mean, there's, I don't know how many universities have marketing as a discipline, a lot. There's thousands of books about this. We've been at marketing for hundreds of years. Why is the definition of it so widely varied, industry to industry, company to company?
Well, you could argue, and I'm going to get academic here. So I would argue that the algorithm for they created more shareholder value or stakeholder value from the end of World War II to the introduction of Google was what I refer to as the brand era. And that is, the way to print money and create billions of shareholder value was loosely speaking, to take a mediocre product, a mediocre shoe, a mediocre car, a mediocre sugary drink, come up with these amazing brand codes of European elegance
or masculinity or, the vision of paternal behavior from America or youth or sex appeal. And then use this incredibly efficient and cheap, we didn't realize how cheap it was till the last 20 years, vehicle called broadcast media to pound away at those associations and then stuff the channel and hope the channel didn't screw up that brand equity too much. And then sell these products at 70, 80, 90 points of gross margin and turn 30 cents of solvent into $3 of European elegance or hand wash to turn 30 cents of a peanut butter paste into maternal love because choosy moms choose Jif and sell it for $3. This was just the license to print money. And now with the introduction of Google and all these other weapons of kind of mass diligence, you no longer need to defer as readily to the brand. And you can find the right peanut butter from Costco that costs a lot less. You can find the hotel that isn't the Four Seasons or the Ritz-Carlton and don't need to defer to the brand because you have TripAdvisor. So as a result, I think we've left the brand era, or the sun has passed midday on brand era. And we're in what I would call, unfortunately, the monopoly era. Some people would call it the semiconductor era, or the microchip or silicon era. But in general, I think the way that companies have created massive shareholder value over the last 20 years is to have a 10x better product, establish themselves as the leader, raise so much more capital than everyone else that they're able to make these incredible, erect these incredible moats of human capital spending, lower prices, whatever it might be, IP, lobbying in Washington, or all of the above. And then they print money. And unfortunately, that era involves much bigger spoils for a much fewer number of players. And the reflex memory is around brand or traditional brand building. And the curriculum at NYU Stern, the marketing department there, and the marketing department, I would argue, at most of the top 20 business schools, we have a curriculum that primarily trains somebody to go get a job at Kraft and be laid off 2 years later. The kind of general skill set of brand building, it's not that it's gone away. It's just that there's fewer jobs. And more every day, more money is taken out of kind of traditional brand building activities and put into what are more kind of processing power or algorithmically driven decision making around discovery, execution, e-commerce, et cetera. So brand building, you would argue, is either going away or it's evolved dramatically in terms of what it's building. But we still have this reflex memory, or at least guys like me and my generation are like, brand is everything. And what we mean by that is brand codes and advertising. And that era has kind of just, Don Draper is not only dead, he's been drawn and quartered and hung in the public square. When I first came out of business school, I got very lucky with Profit, with a brand strategy firm, and people wanted a young guy in the room, and I shaved my head so everybody thought I understood technology and was smarter than I am. And I would get
big glasses too. Yeah, big glasses.
Big glasses, the part, the role. And I would get invited to board meetings. I got invited to sit in board meetings at Levi Strauss & Company at the age of 29. And when I went into these board meetings, there'd be guys like Nigel Bogle or Lee Clow. The ad guys were always in the boardroom. They were the CEO whisperers. They were Lee Clow was advising Steve Jobs. It was this, the brand guys had a seat at the table. Jim, I can't tell you the last time I saw an ad guy in a boardroom. They're just not there.
No, so, they haven't been for years.
So the traditional, generously you'd say brand building has changed. But the reality is the era of brand, I would argue, is kind of coming to a close. It's transitioned to something else.
What would you say is the key to success for today's CMO? If you said data, you wouldn't be the only one. At Deloitte, however, we believe data is only half of the equation. The other half, story. Because data is the language of business, but story is the language of humans. And we believe the most successful CMOs know how to harness the power of both data and story. To learn more about Deloitte's CMO program and how we can help today's CMOs succeed, visit cmo.deloitte.com.
Scott, you come to I teach an academy at the Cannes Festival every year for CMOs. This year we have 50 plus coming, and Scott, you're speaking to them again, and you've been so kind to come the last several years and talk about tech and the breakup and the big four and what you would do if you were the CMO of a, quote, traditional company. So what are you going to tell the CMOs this year when you come to Cannes and talk to these 50 CMOs? You going to say what you just said or something else?
So I think every CEO and CMO, kind of my big thing, I try and pick a one theme every year. And my big theme this year is that I believe the world is distilling down to a small number of kind of what I refer to as rundles. And that's an acronym for recurring revenue bundle. So the most obvious one is Prime. You get a lot of great things from Prime and you decide, I don't use all of them, but it's such an incredible offer. I'll pay $119 a year. Netflix is a recurring revenue bundle. If you, you and I fly Delta, SkyTeam is a recurring, you know, to a certain extent, it's not recurring revenue, but it's a bundle of, I'll fly Air France to Paris next week, even though I don't love the airline because I've gone all in on this kind of monogamous relationship with a group of brands all strung together through SkyTeam. And I think the world is distilling, as it did in the airline industry, down to a small number of networks. I think the brand world is going to distill down, or the consumer world is going to distill down to a small number of networks. And the reason why is that we have mistaken choice for a good thing. And I, like Sheena Iyengar, the professor of marketing at Columbia, says that it's not that we want more choice. We want fewer choices. We just want to be more confident in the choices we make. So I think where we're, what we're going to see is a small number of brands kind of become the helm of the bobsled and either acquire and or strike relationships with other brands to create a recurring revenue offering that uses artificial and organic intelligence, charges you a yearly fee, and kind of takes your entire consumer purchases in that sector off the table. So, for example, I think Nike could be that lead dog, if you will, in the fitness space. And then if they came up with a bundle that said, Scott, you're an aging athlete. We know you're, you know, trying to barely hold on with your fingernails to your last vestiges of youth. So we're going to, you're going to pay us $1,000, $2,000, $5,000 a year. We automatically ship you your Vaporfly shoes. We have ingredient branded hotels that have better gyms, better food, such that you don't have to eat this kind of, I don't know, delayed onset diabetes that I eat when I'm on the food. The menus and room service are just so awful. And we're going to take your fitness and your health kind of off the table. And we even have a set of pre-approved orthopedic surgeons. So when you get your knee operated on because you won't stop running, we have a group of Nike affiliated people, fitness programs. We have a deal with Lululemon because we know you like their workout clothes better than ours, whatever it might be. The marketplace loves monogamy. And if a company can show that the fastest growing part of its company is a recurring revenue part of its company, it moves into a different weight class from a shareholder standpoint, because companies with recurring revenue businesses are valued at a multiple of revenues, and companies with transactional businesses like a P&G or a Target that have to constantly reinvent the business every day and still stay hot and still flirt with their customers over and over and over and aren't in a monogamous relationship but a transactional relationship, they're valued at a multiple of EBITDA. So if you're a company, and most of the companies I work with are going to grow sort of 4 to 6% a year. I think I work with a lot of the same companies you work with, and those 50 CMOs that'll be in that room will be in, you know, largely work for companies that at least organic growth is going to kind of be low single digits. And so if they're going to grow the revenues 20 to 30% organically over the next 5 years, but they have to say to the investment markets, there's a reasonable chance we're going to double shareholder value, because Netflix and Microsoft can make a very compelling case. They will double their shareholder value over the next 5 years. The only way they're going to achieve that is to move to the better model of Microsoft. And that is, Microsoft has the ultimate monogamous relationship with the corporate world in the form of Microsoft Office. And nobody divorces Microsoft. People occasionally flirt with G Suite or something like that, but for the most part, they continue to pay that money to Microsoft so they can have Word and Excel, et cetera. The divorce rate is almost non-existent with Prime. The only time people cancel Prime is when they move in with someone else or their credit card does, you know, expires. Netflix is an unbelievable model. And if you look at the companies adding a ton of shareholder value, Jim, they've gone to this recurring revenue bundle. So long-winded way of saying, I think every CMO needs to figure out a strategy such that he or she can oversee the programming, the content, and the execution of a component or a bundling or a service component of the business that becomes the fastest growing part of the business. Even if it's off a small base, that's okay. But we're all headed to haves and have-nots. And the haves in the corporate world from a shareholder standpoint are going to be the ones that convince consumers to enter into this recurring revenue relationship with them.
So Scott, if you're the CMO of Unilever, AB InBev, Kraft Heinz, any of them that have a large brand, Johnson & Johnson, how would you get started? What's your pragmatic advice in getting started to build some sort of end-to-end recurring revenue, you know, system based on, I mean, consumer habits, right? Travel, athletics, food and beverage, different aspects of your life, if you can take that over for them and build it into a recurring revenue model, it's very powerful. How do you get started?
Yeah, home care, baby. There's a ton of segments as you think about it. So you and I know these people. And by the way, you put together the best room of CMOs in the world at Cannes. I think it's always an incredibly impressive group of people. So first off, you have to have what I'd call a man in the mirror test or a woman in the mirror test and realize that even if you're AB InBev, even if you're P&G, you probably don't have the portfolio to pull this off on your own. You can in certain niches, but if you wanted to do a grand bargain with a consumer, say you're P&G, and I think it'd be realistic for P&G to say, you know what? We just want to take your home care, your I don't know what you call this segment in laundry. What's that called? Clothing care, apparel? Fabric.
All of
that, care. Maybe even your personal hygiene, or whatever it might be. We're just going to take this whole home bundle off the table. And if we don't have the brand you love, we have the number two brand, and we're going to give you a fantastic deal because we recognize we're fulfilling stuff automatically, so we'll save some costs on marketing. The marketplace loves these recurring revenues. We're just going to give you an unbelievable deal in terms of new products, new discovery, and the price we charge you every month and fulfillment options. And I think the first thing you got to realize is there's very few companies that could pull this off on their own. And that is one of the key things that gets in the way of strategy, I find, with CPG companies is they mistake their competitors for their enemies. P&G and Unilever are not enemies, they're competitors. Their enemy is in Seattle. Nike and Adidas are competitors, they're not enemies, their enemy is in Seattle. I think every company faces an existential threat from Amazon. I think Jeff Bezos is the white knight. He is coming for the living. Nobody is safe. And I think you're going to see a series of strange bedfellows where when the, the Panzer tanks rolled into Slovakia and Poland, the British, the Russians, and the Germans figured out a way to get along. I mean, the British and the Russians hated each other a lot more than P&G and Unilever. But what I'm trying to tell people is the Panzer tanks are here. P&G is coming for your lunch. They see your margin as their opportunity, and they've partnered with 80% of U.S. wealthy households, 2/3 of all households, fanatical investors, amazing technology, and a government that doesn't seem to want to regulate these tech monopolies, even though they're monopolies, to basically starch the margin from all brands. And if we don't start seeing this as an existential threat and create allies where we would have just never dreamt of before to offer sort of these grand bargain bundles, I don't think it's going to work. So I think P&G needs to be sitting down with Unilever, Samsung, Nike, and saying, what could we do to pull off something just incredible here in terms of some sort of consumer offering and charge a recurring revenue fee? The other is the board has to hold hands around the fire and say, this costs a lot of money. If you look at the recurring revenue bundles that work, there's nothing that romantic there. Netflix spends $12 billion on original content every year. And it's just, so I basically get $1 billion in original content for every dollar a month I send to Netflix. That's the offering you are competing against. So in the short run, and even in the medium run, this offering is not going to offer the same unit economics as your traditional channels. I find boards in general love the term innovation. They just don't love the term investment, or the two are do not foot to one another. So one is imagining being realistic about how strong your brand portfolio is on its own, pushing the limits of your comfort zone in terms of partnering with other companies, and then having a board and a CEO that demonstrate the leadership to the markets to say, yeah, our stock may go down here, our profits are going to take a hit, but we have to come up with the type of offering and the type of value proposition being offered across other sectors when Netflix has taken TV off the table. I mean, millennials will spend more time watching Netflix than the rest of cable television combined. Mm-hmm. Netflix will do more revenue this year than the entire receipts of the entire domestic box office. Even with Avengers Endgame and all of that, it still doesn't match the revenue of Netflix. So that is what you're competing against. Otherwise, we're going to be just picking up the scraps. We're going to be filling in niches around when someone needs fabric softener, or when someone needs lunch, or when someone needs, gets excited by the hottest new shirt, which doesn't last forever. We have to move to these kind of what I'll call networks, and companies need to be realistic about their brand portfolio and the requisite investment.
And Scott, we just talked a few minutes ago about the role of marketing and the work of marketing and what is a CMO's job. I mean, you just described it, right? And by the way, that's really interesting work. it's really it's awesome work, and who wouldn't want to do that in a career? So anyway, The Algebra of Happiness, you know, I read your book, The Big Four. I recommend it to a lot of people. It was fabulous, and a lot of people that I work with still cite it, and it's inspired them. So The Algebra of Happiness is sort of a 180. So and I haven't read it yet. It's not in the market for a few weeks, I think you told me. Could you tell us a little bit about why you did that, and why the video you did about this inspired such interest?
So thanks. That's a generous question, Jim. So my process for writing books, and I know you've written books, is that I take my most popular class, and then I do a video, and if the video resonates, I do a book. And my second most popular class is a book on the big four platforms, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Did a video, it got 1.1 million views. And my publisher approached me and said, with this kind of resonance on YouTube, you should write a book, wrote a book, did well. And then the book business, and I didn't know this, it was my first book, but if you have a successful book, you're supposed to write a second one immediately, because the prime is pumped, right? Or the pump is primed, and they know who you are, and Barnes & Noble and Amazon will pre-order a bunch, and the algorithms see that you pre-ordered a bunch, and it's kind of an upward spiral. So it doesn't, you know, they came, my publisher came back to me, Penguin Portfolio Random House, which is, you know, arguably the best business book publisher in the world. At least that's what they keep telling me. And they'll say, God, you got to get, this is great. You got to get another book out there. And I'm like, well, I don't really have a vision for one. It doesn't matter. Write something called the five, the one, whatever that is. Just get a new book out there. And I came back and I said about 6 months later, okay, I've written a book and I'm really excited about it. And they're like, great, great. What's it about? I'm like, it's about happiness. And there's a pause. And they're like, no, 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 no. Write about Amazon, write about Google, write about Tencent, write about Alibaba, but happiness. And they said, we don't publish that kind of book, Scott. That's not what you're known for. And I said, look, I'm in a position where I'm not writing for economic security. It's not my primary gig. I write books because I want my kids to read them when I'm gone and understand me better. And I have a modest goal. I want to be the most influential thought leader in the history of business. I'm still not there, but books can help me get there. And my most popular session is the last session I give at school, and it's called The Algebra of Happiness. And over the course of 20 years working with successful people, teaching 4,500 students, my own personal observations, having gone through a lot of peaks and valleys professionally and personally, what is the difference between success and happiness? And I've tried to identify and support with research some best practices and distill it down to a series of equations around what generally creates an arc of satisfaction. Happiness is a bit of a misnomer, because happiness technically is a sensation that you can get from Chipotle or Netflix or a Maker's and Ginger. But how do you create certain best practices in your life that result in an arc or a narrative of happiness such that as you get towards the end of your life, you feel as if you could drop the mic or that you had checked a lot of boxes in sort of indelible ink? I take the kids through these equations, and the class is very popular. I did the video. The video got over 2 million views, and so I wrote a book. And it comes out in 2 weeks.
So, Scott, when are you happiest? What's the equation?
I'm hands down happiest when my kids crawl into bed with me in the morning, and both of them on weekends, you know, come in. We're pack animals. We're generally happiest. The research shows when we're kind of in motion and surrounded by people we love. So I'm half of that. I'm happiest when I'm surrounded by my boys. And, you know, my youngest is, I'm having trouble connecting with my 8-year-old. I talk about that in the book. My 11-year-old, we connected through soccer and we love the same TV. My 8-year-old and I haven't found those things yet. And we have a tough time connecting, and he tests me a lot. And I describe him affectionately as the terrorist in our household. It's like we've had an insurgent hole up in our household with us. He's difficult. But every morning he comes in tired and he grabs me, lays on me like he's hugging a tree, and then he spills over into the middle of the bed. And, you know, Jim, you just have those feelings where it's like, okay, I'm still a blink in the cosmic universe, but my blink matters because, you know, I have this kid, this thing that trusts me and loves me completely, and I love it completely. I think the universe wants to prosper. And I've thought a lot about and done a decent amount of research into this notion of love. And there's kind of three types of love. There's the love you get as a young person from the people who provide you unconditional love. There's transactional love, which most young people pursue. They offer love in exchange for something back, intimacy, partnership economically, sex, pleasing their parents or societal norms. And then there's complete love, and complete love is deciding to just be, you know, irrationally passionate about someone else's well-being, regardless of what you get back. And the universe needs those people because it's the key to the success of our species. And as a result, it is the most rewarding type of love. And the first time, quite frankly, I don't have the confidence or the emotional security to have reached that with anyone else other than my boys. And so I find time with my boys is in fact the most rewarding thing for me.
So Scott, let's stay on this happiness thing for a moment. Let's go back to the CMO theme. How can CMOs in their organizations, what in that book can help them build an organization that is happier, that is more courageous, that is more daring, that has more love?
You know, I'm not sure it can. It's such a hard left. The book for me is a lot about relationships and approach to work. I think there's a few things as I'm just trying to think it through it. So look, there's no silver bullet. Everyone has kind of their own algebra of happiness, but generally the key best practice that's present most often in people's lives who do report a lot of satisfaction is that the largest study on happiness is the Harvard Grant study. They tracked 400 men from the age of 19 to kind of 99 when the last one died. And it gives you a sense, it was 1929, it gives you a sense of what society was like, is that we chose to track 400 men. It's like, women, don't worry about their happiness. But they chose 400 men and tracked them for 80 years. They had to swap out four principal scientists because they kept dying. And they took this massive data set looking at everything from what they ate, their physical activity, their jobs, their income, their relationships, everything, and then constantly queried them on how happy and satisfied they felt. And then they had the most robust longitudinal data set ever compiled on happiness. And they found that in general, the key signal, the strongest signal around happiness was, one, do you feel loved and supported at home? And just as importantly, do you know they sense intense love and support from you? And then with your friends, do you have a sense of joy and camaraderie? And do they sense joy and camaraderie from you? And then also at work, do you feel admired and respected and relevant? And also, do other people get a sense that you admire and respect and find their work relevant? So I think a CMO, you know, I used to think culture and HR were just such bullshit when I was a younger man. And now I've come to realize that one of the few sustainable assets, whether it's an HBO or an Apple, is culture. You know, HBO will spend $2 billion, Netflix will spend $12 billion, Amazon will spend $8 billion. And they can't get anywhere near Game of Thrones, much less Girls, much less Veep. They just can't. They can't seem to find it. And it's because HBO's created this incredible culture. Samsung will spend more on marketing than Apple, but they still can't get near Apple products because Apple's figured out some sort of creative process that it's very hard to reverse engineer. So I think if you can create a culture where people who admire and respect and consistently demonstrate those things for other people in your organization, and you set up the vehicles for camaraderie. One of the things I hated about being acquired is they canceled this thing we call Champagne Friday. The number one source of retention for people at work is if they have a friend, if they have a good friend at work. And so giving people the ability to make friendships at work, and I'm not talking about wild parties or kind of this frat bro culture that's emerged at some of these tech companies, but I think if you can create a culture of camaraderie and where people appreciate each other and can make connections and become good friends. A lot of iconic companies in the 50s and 60s started softball leagues. And I think that stuff is really powerful. Right. So I would think of it as CMO is obviously usually an outward facing company or an outward facing role. But, you know, the happiness stuff, I think your relationship with your peers at work is a key component of happiness.
We did a many, many year longitudinal study at P&G about the leaders who were effective in the long term and who became the leaders of the company. And of all of the attributes we looked at, the one that was present in nearly all of them was the relationship with their first boss. It's just, you know, whether it was where they went to school, what their work experience was like, what the aptitude tests were, what the career path was, we could not find any relationship. The only dominant relationship was how strong the relationship was when they came to the company with their first boss.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, you know, you strike me as someone to be a good manager. Oh, you must've been a good manager to rise to that position at P&G, but when I first started my business, I thought that just being a good manager, being generally just awesome, and being a good person. Like if I'm great at what I do and I'm a good person, that makes me a good manager. And what you realize as you get older, you know, setting expectations, constant feedback, developing a sense of empathy where you say, look, you may not be like, I assumed everyone was like me. I assumed everyone just generally wanted to be awesome and make a shit ton of money. And I assumed the whole world was like that. And then as you get older, you realize, well, some people have different priorities at work. And trying to create a sense of empathy where you really spend time with your direct reports and saying, hey, I may not entirely get you, but I'm going to try hard. And then I'm going to try and deliver against those things for you. So you always feel like I'm in your corner. I think loyalty is a function of appreciation. And the way you demonstrate appreciation is you take time to say, I'm going to try and figure you out and really understand what you want and try and help you get there or what's important to you. And I'm also going to provide you with constant feedback. I encourage all of my managers to good, bad. You notice anything good in any opportunity or something someone's not doing well, grab them for 20 seconds, pull them into a conference room and say, don't stop doing this. That was great. Keep doing this. Or pull them in and say, you might want to think about improving or modifying around this kind of thing. And you know, when I first got it, the only real job I've ever had is I worked at Morgan Stanley, and our feedback was once a year in the form of a bonus check. That was it. And I remember walking into my review at Morgan Stanley and thinking, I don't know if I'm going to get a 100% bonus or get fired, which means they were just shitty managers. I had no loyalty to the organization. I had some loyalty to my first boss. It's interesting what you said. He took on a paternal or a big brother role for me. So I was very loyal to him because I thought he was going to kind of protect me, if you will. But other than that, it was just a terrible culture. Anyways, it's been a while now. It's been a while.
So Scott, I want to wrap up with sort of a lightning round. And the first one is, any book you're reading now?
I'm embarrassed to say it. I don't read a lot of books. Okay. I read a ton, but I don't read a ton of books. I think like the best book I've read of the last few years, I think every business person or just everyone should read is Sapiens. I'm going back and I'm trying to read it again because I felt like it was so interesting and important. And my next life, I'm coming back as an evolutionary anthropologist. I just find that stuff fascinating. And if you want to be a CMO, you want to be a great marketer, I think you need to understand biology. We're all animals, and any great brand, any great business taps into some sort of instinct.
Yeah. It's on my shelf, by the way. I'm reading Bad Blood now, but that's next up. So what series are you watching? You're looking forward to Stranger Things, or is there something else you're watching now that's really great?
Well, yeah, I'm obsessed with Game of Thrones. I think this thing is so inspiring that somebody took this book and managed to get episodes done at $15 million. Whoever is the producer who greenlighted this thing should be given the Medal of Freedom. Because if someone had said, okay, we're going to have these battles in Iceland and then we're going to have dragons, it could have been so expensive, but so bad at the same time if they hadn't pulled it off. And this thing is just, I think television is the defining art form of our age. If you look back in 100 years, I don't think they're going to look at impressionist art, modern art. I think they're going to say television was the defining art form. And a lot of it's just resources. You know, Netflix will spend more money on original scripted television than all of the networks, all of the cable companies combined just 10 years ago. So we have just so many, you know, you want the key to happiness? Watch more television. There's just amazing TV out there right now.
Yeah.
So anyways, Game of Thrones for me. And I watch a ton of series. I love Veep. I think if you want to know somebody, look at their Netflix home screen. What are you watching, Jim?
Patriot. I just finished Patriot. I loved it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so dark. It's so quirky. It's fantastic. Fantastic. And I'm a Stranger Things addict too. I'll just stream that the minute it comes out on July 4th.
Yeah, that's nice.
So any podcast you're listening to now?
I really like The Daily from The New York Times. I think it does just a fantastic job. I'm doing a podcast. I do a podcast with Kara Swisher called Pivot, and it's been a real learning experience for me. I was on her podcast, and I had never listened to one before I was a guest, and then we started co-hosting one. I find the medium fascinating. It's one of the few ad-supported mediums that's growing. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting when the medium is the message. When people come up to me and they've seen my videos, it's kind of a tech bro and they high-five me like, way to go, man, or peace or whatever, or respect, right? when I do my blog, No Mercy, No Malice, and I write about my family, I get long, thoughtful responses from parents and CMOs who respect the work, and they put in some work into their response. And when you meet somebody who likes your podcast, they feel as if they're your friend. They feel as if they know you. And there's something about being in the ear of somebody and audio where they come up to you and it's as if you've met three or four times. It's really nice. And they're your friend. So I'm enjoying the podcasting thing a lot. I listen to the daily. I listen to a bunch of ones that are successful because I want to understand what drives success in podcasting. I think it's super interesting medium. It's something, you know, I think both you and I want to get really good at, right?
Oh, we're working on it.
Let's flip the mic here, and then I know you got to cut me loose. What's going on with Jim Stengel? I know that you have this great partnership, work and personal partnership with your wife. How are your kids? What's important for Jim Stengel right now?
Scott, actually, a lot of the same things you talked about, and I'm not just saying that to be patronizing. I mean, my wife and I are married 36 years. She had a birthday this week. She came to New York with me. We just love hanging out together. There's nothing I love more than being with her.
That's nice. And it's so basic and so hard to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the most important decision you'll make, and I ask my kids this, and it's in the book, I ask the kids, what's the most important decision you're making? They say the industry you choose or, you know, your approach to life. And also, like, by far the most important decision you'll make is who you partner with in life. And that is who you marry. And it's got such downside if you make the wrong decision. And it's got such upside if you make the right decision.
You know who also said that to me, Scott? I went to a cocktail party a couple of years ago and no one was there except Warren Buffett. So I was in a room alone with him and I said, hey, I'm never going to do this again. What can I learn from you? I introduced myself. The first thing he said was almost verbatim what you said. The most important choice in life, and I tell this to all my young people, is who they spend it with. Nothing else is close. Not what you, how much money you make, not what industry you're in, not where you live. It's who you spend your life with.
100%. I did a bunch of research around, how do you pick the right partner? And most of the research show it's kind of, there's three legs of the school. The first is, and it's the one most people, young people are focused on. It's attraction, sex and affection. Identify your relationship as singular. That's important. Two is values, religion, you know, the role of your parents in your life, how many kids you want, all that good stuff. But the third thing that people don't talk about when they're young and they assume it'll just all work out, and it's the number one cause of divorce, is your approach to money. And that is, what are your expectations around money? Who's going to make it? How much are you going to spend? Who's responsible for the economic well-being? Because most people think that infidelity or not shared values is the number one source of divorce. It isn't. The number one source of divorce is economic agita. So anyways, but kids mostly focus on the first. Yep. You don't think much about the second and the third.
Yeah. So Scott, it's been a blast. One last question. Who else would you like to see on this podcast hosted by me? Who else would you like to hear from?
The Night King. Bring on the Night King, Jim.
We'll work on it. We'll work on it.
Bring on the Night King. Winter is here.
All right, Scott.
Who went from Game of Thrones, Jim? Anyone.
All right. Okay. All right. Very good. Thanks, Scott. Loved it. Enjoyed it. Thanks for doing this.
Take care.
That was my conversation with Scott. What I love most was how tender he was about when he's happiest, and those times are when he's snuggling with his kids on weekends. And if you know Scott, you know, you think he's a bit gruff and a bit short, but actually beyond that surface, he's a sweet, loving dad. That's it for this episode of the CMO Podcast. If you found this helpful and entertaining, I would be so grateful if you could share our show with your friends. And I would be super happy if you subscribe so you can be updated as we publish new episodes. And if you really want to help, leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The CMO Podcast is a Gallery Media Group original production.